Welcome to the Navigating the Apps Marketplace panel for the State of the Mobile Net Conference. Thank you so much for coming. We just had some interesting keynote discussions from Glenn Lowery from AT&T, who negotiated the deal with the iPhone on behalf of AT&T. He also negotiated the deal for the iPad on AT&T with Apple. And what we wanted to do, so that got us thinking a lot over lunch. What we wanted to do going back several months, thinking about this panel, is that within the past 12 to 18 months, with the advent of the App Store and the introduction of the Android platform and all the other marketplaces that are out there from BlackBerry, from Nokia, from Windows Mobile, and Palm, for that matter, we wanted to kind of pull out the fact that, in our estimation, some of the most exciting things that are happening on app-enabled devices within the App Store. There are issues related to privacy, security, safety, and we thought that was really worth discussing because it seems to be a place that's on fire. And it's we need to put in context, I think, the importance of that epicenter for public policy decision makers. Not to say that there should be regulation or legislation, but understanding the marketplace is going to be very, very important in how things work. We also wanted to kind of look at a little bit, which we kind of found peculiar, is a robust, thriving, exploding marketplace. There doesn't seem to be any rules for how people find apps and what apps they like and what apps they choose. And I'm a bit of a dinosaur, but I just ask my friends what apps they have. And after the panel, I need to ask you what Android apps you like. And that's how I find apps. And we thought that was, how can this continue to be? And let me just give you one anecdote from the past on understanding a major policy issue, in my view, and understanding the marketplace and how it works. Years ago, back in the late 1990s, the White House was very concerned about privacy, online privacy, e-commerce privacy, call it Web 1.1 privacy. The White House was concerned. Folks on the Hill wanted to legislate, and they tried to get industry to move in a certain direction institute fair information practices on the World Wide Web. Mm-hmm. And one thing that they didn't quite understand in that how the marketplace worked was that advertising, now take this with a grain of salt, but advertising and network advertising in many cases happens so quickly across a huge ecosystem of banner ads, and this is banner ads at the time, so pretty rudimentary compared to what we have today, but the reality was that it was happening so fast, there are so many different intermediaries in the process of online advertising that it wasn't clear that Procter & Gamble didn't exactly know who was placing their ad or where the ad was being placed, and they just were far behind understanding how that marketplace worked, and they thought that it was a pretty top-down approach to advertising the way it is in a newspaper. And I think I only raise that issue because I think we're in the same place with regard to the apps marketplace, and I think that if we understand that a little bit better, I think, you know, policymakers would be, you know, better positioned to kind of understand what's happening in the marketplace. So that's my introduction, and I'm sorry for taking so long, but that's what kind of got us moving on this issue. We have three speakers today. Jonathan Spalter. Jonathan Spalter has a biography that I will post on the internet, on the webpage after we get done, but it's one of those things where I say, what have I been doing for the past decade? Jonathan has been, he's with Mobile Future. He's been the CEO of Snowcap, which was the Sean Fanning digital download music licensing project. He was with the Dewey Square Group, grassroots. He's in everything from speech writing for Al Gore to creating green-friendly cartoons. This one's called Climate Cartoons. And the one that you produced was called, it was a great title for the cartoon.
Big Fun.
Big Fun with Global Warming, which I thought was fantastic. So, and so Jonathan will kind of give a bit of an overview. We have Sasha Sagan returning from last year for our first annual State of the Mobile Net Conference, and Sasha is the managing editor for PC Magazine, does mobile issues for PC Magazine, writes about these things all the time, knows this stuff better than anybody on the planet, came down from New York, and thank you so much, Sasha. And Ginny Goodmanson, I was going to have trouble pronouncing that until I got a phonetic help from Alan Simpson. Ginny works for Common Sense Media. She is the executive editor of phone apps and video games games for Common Sense Media. She also writes a weekly syndicated Kid Tech column for USA Today. And it's interesting that Ginny, for Common Sense Media, there is already a phone apps editor, which I think is amazing and shows how fast things are happening. So if I could just start off with Jonathan, just give us a bit of a framework.
Sure, I appreciate that. And thank you for the introduction, because I think it really set a good foundation for what we can talk about. I'm going to try to pick off that piece of what Tim said, which is how this works. I want to talk a little bit about the biology, taxonomy, and in a sense the geography of apps and where they're going. And you use the word, Ginny's name is a little bit hard to pronounce, and you use the word explosive. Explosive has been the dominant metaphor for the extraordinary growth of apps and app stores over the last few years. It reminds you of the volcanoes, and I will try now to pronounce that Icelandic volcano. Aya pla fya yurkadal. And with that, I will continue. Look, let's just take a quick look at where we are in apps and app stores. Right now, there are, some believe, because the number really isn't hard yet, but 68 app stores that are now fully deployed. It's a number that's growing. We can't actually say exactly what the number is, because there are actually now some even cloud-based stores that are being created, not just by larger companies, but by, in fact, smaller developers in their garages. What's happening within the apps world? We know a lot of the numbers. I don't want to rehearse those again for you right now, beyond the explosive growth that we've seen at multiples that are astonishing as what we heard Glenn talk about during his speech. Know a couple of things about the specifics of what these apps are beginning to look like. Roughly 3 in 4 apps that are now deployed across the major stores are paid apps. Only 1/4 are free. In what kind of content are they providing? The numbers are actually pretty steady. There has been a sustainability of a majority of apps being downloaded are being focused on content that's skewing towards games and entertainment, around 65%, depending what app store, but the mean number is about 65%, with utilities and personalization services bringing up the rear. Although some interesting growth, particularly on Android, on utilities and personalization, we're seeing that there is roughly now, if you look at what kind of new project starts that we're seeing developers commit to, what kind of platforms are being supported, really interesting. There's a service called Flurry out there in the web that provides back-end and development support for apps developers. According to their numbers, roughly 22%, 1/4 of all new apps project starts have been committed just to the iPad. This is in the last couple of months. It's really interesting to see. All this is to say that there's remarkable growth, and therefore some analysts who are working with those in the financial sectors that care about these types of issues are projecting that overall by 2013, in fact, Apple, though it has the dominant app store now, will be pushed down to about 30% of the overall market. That's not to say that Apple is and the iPhone store isn't going to continue to grow, but given the explosive overall growth of the ecosystem, we're simply going to be seeing the pie grow larger as competition actually increases and picks up in the space. What are apps? I mean, what is the essential functionality of an app? An app, in many respects, it allows app stores exist to maximize the usefulness of a platform by allowing third-party developers and innovators to increase the platform's capabilities. It is the ultimate, Mark Twain would be proud, Tom Sawyer business model. Come paint my fence. And that is, in a sense, that user-generated content concept has become, in many respects, the hallmark, the defining, almost philosophical hallmark of the development and the future of web and web-based applications, and increasingly we'll see in mobile applications. Let me just quickly go through where we are. There are three fundamental participants in the applications ecosystem. We know that they're the operators, they're the developers, and there's us, the consumers. And because there are three, it has, in the e-commerce sense, made it a bit of a Rubik's Cube, a rather multidimensional, complex interaction that has really created a number of new development requirements that we're all beginning to see but still in their infant form. Requirements that include such a diverse array of development feats that folks out in Silicon Valley, where I spend most of my time, are busy working on, including implementation, the deployment of catalogs and database architecture and metadata architecture, the deployment of developer sales metrics so we know, you know, what's winning and what's losing and who needs to get paid. There are these very early stages of trying to figure out what are the approvals processes. We're beginning to hear a little bit about those as they are being implemented across these multiple applications stores. There are increasingly complex requirements for device support, for iterations and implementations of new versions and upgrades. We're also seeing the added complexity now that developers are not just committing the resources for implementation on iPhone, but there are multi-store, multi-platform implementation requirements where one developer is actually deploying across various platforms at the same time. The important thing to note, though, is that despite the complexity of the requirements, right now, functionality still is incredibly primitive. What does it look like? It really looks like your iTunes functionality back at version 1.0. What you can essentially do now within these app stores at very simplistic technological levels are essentially browsing menus and search for ratings and reviews. There still are a number of iterations of software and more elegant algorithms that are going to be deployed across these app stores that are going to allow for more complex and more sophisticated and therefore potentially more profitable e-commerce on the app stores. Those are going to include things like personalization, geolocation, cross-selling, upselling, video demos within apps, and similar types of functionalities. There's also a very interesting thing that we're seeing. It's a phenomenon, but the app store world is skewing towards winners. Because results are listed by total revenue or total download, it's the existing early winners that are actually in a sort of a self-supporting place. Later developers, people who are coming in with new ideas and new interesting apps are way down at the long part of the long tail and are having a very big challenge finding ways to break through. Another interesting characteristic that we're seeing, and I think this is going to shift, is that systemically most of the app stores are being actually built by either internally or by systems integrators. I think within the on a proprietary basis within the various companies, I think that's going to begin to shift, and we're going to be seeing various parts, various actors and participants actually building and implementing app stores. A lot of stuff still to come. There are going to be really interesting new ways we're going to be seeing for the monetization of intellectual property on the apps. We're going to be seeing also a very interesting new phenomenon, which is being expressed right now through just the deployment of the Google App Store, which is really focusing in the cloud on B2B business types of applications and services, where instead of an individual having access to only one license for the application's functionalities, we're going to be beginning to see businesses and even consumers being able to get multi-user licenses from apps. The last thing I'd say is, two last things. One, again, we have this three-part ecosystem. Eventually, we're going to see, I think, consumers being able to speak within the apps directly to the developers, which is going to create even more interesting and innovative implementations of applications going forward. And the last thing I'd say is the unpaid part of the applications world is shrinking, the free part. One big growing part of the freely deployed applications that we're seeing really take hold in interesting ways are applications that I call common good or public purpose applications. The deployment, for example, of the White House application. There are new applications in the state where I am, California, which you can download to allow you to do mobile-based petition signing for referenda. There are going to be a number of other types of publicly beneficial applications that will support, not limit, civic engagement and the delivery of public resources such as health, education, public safety that we're going to be seeing in these application stores that will become a fundamental and increasingly important part of this exciting new ecosystem that we're all watching explode in front of us.
Well, I think it's really interesting that we had this keynote lunch by Clem Laurie, who negotiated the deal for the iPhone. And as I said, you know, before we started the panel, he said one telling thing which I was kind of shocked by. He said, you know, as far as AT&T having rules about negotiating deals with different companies, they have all these internal procedures and things like that. And he said, negotiating the deal for the iPhone, they broke every one of their internal corporate rules for negotiation. Every one of them. He said he broke every single rule about how they treat, you know, customer relationship. And he said, because we had to. And I think he said it paid off, obviously, for them, I think. Sasha, we talked a lot about, you know, the pace of this thing. This is breaking all the rules. There's different approaches. There's closed systems. There's open systems, hybrid systems, app stores. Can you kind of, you have a great perch from which to see all these things happening. Can you kind of give us some overview on why, what's happening here and why policymakers should care or should understand?
Sure. Well, I'm as interested in what the questions that you guys have as in anything we have to say, but I'll try to give you some thoughts and set the scene a bit. First of all, yes, it definitely did pay off for AT&T because for their wireless profitability, AT&T is now completely dependent on the iPhone. And everyone there, all the blood drains out of their face when you talk about the day when they lose the exclusivity for the iPhone. So, yeah, it paid off, but it may come back and bite them. Okay, so we're all Americans, or most of you work in government, you could safely say that all of those civics classes we took in high school probably took in our heads. And we have clear ideas in our minds of, well, we like freedom, we like fairness, we like open competition, stuff like that. So when you read this, when you read all of the news coverage and you read all of the griping out there about Apple's grim and anti-competitive practices, what are you to think? Is this important? Is this something you need to do something about? Well, here's the landscape that this is happening in and that these app stores are living in and some things to think about. As we just heard, yeah, there are 60-something app stores out there right now. But the three most, probably the three most frequently downloaded from are Apple's official iPhone app store, iPhone and iPod Touch app store, the Android market on Google Android phones, and BlackBerry's App World, and the various other app stores that serve the BlackBerry platform. And so now when you look at the numbers of apps on each of these platforms, Apple has 150,000 in their app store. Android just hit 38,000. Yay, go Android. BlackBerry refuses to release their numbers, but somewhere around 10,000. And you think, okay, well, of course, Apple dominates the marketplace. No, that's not actually true, because if you look at the number of smartphones that are sold and that are out there, well, BlackBerry totally dominates the marketplace with 42% of the American market. Apple's down at 25, and Android's down at 9. In fact, in the middle there, with 15%, is Windows Mobile, and we haven't even discussed their App Store, because I really don't think anyone's ever used it. What are you to think about the fact that developers are flocking to certain platforms disproportionate to their position in the marketplace? They're not flocking to the BlackBerry, even though it's the most popular smartphone. And they're flocking to certain platforms, even though those platforms are the most closed. There are two ways to run a smartphone platform in terms of app stores. You can be basically open or basically closed. A basically open platform like the BlackBerry, Android, or Palm platforms lets people download apps from various different sources. You could go to the built-in app market, and almost everyone does, but you could go to third parties like Handango or GetJar, or even have an app developer send you a link to their app directly. A basically closed platform like Apple's allows you to download your apps from one place, and that is them. You can hack your phone to accept apps from a third party, but then you void your warranty, and if you break it and try to return it to the store, they will laugh at you. And yet developers go to the most closed platform. What's going on? Well, it turns out that one way, almost politically, to look at this is that, yes, some platforms are more closed, some platforms are more democratic, but that's not the full picture. Would you rather live in Singapore, or would you rather live in, let's say, one of the more poorly performing politically Indian states? Democracy versus totalitarianism doesn't speak to the full life experience. Developers are basically looking at several things. First of all, something called APIs, which are the tools they get to develop on the platform. It turns out that Apple makes it really easy to create beautiful programs. BlackBerry makes it really hard to create beautiful programs. So it's a lot easier to create a terrific app for the iPhone than it is to create an equally rich app for the BlackBerry. Then there's discovery. BlackBerry App World doesn't come loaded by default on many BlackBerries, and it can be slow and difficult to navigate. The iPhone App Store comes, of course, on every iPhone. There's nowhere else for people to go, and Apple keeps on promoting it through TV ads. So developers feel that with Apple, well, they get more promotion and easier discovery. Then there's the business process of the store. Things like when you submit your app, how quickly does it get approved or rejected? What are the policies for approval or rejection? When there's e-commerce involved, how easy is it for people to pay for the app? What are the return policies like? Does a developer have to pay to submit apps to the App Store? So well beyond open and closed, well beyond how many phones are there in the marketplace, there are all of these factors smoothing the developer's path to market that Apple has mastered far beyond what Google and BlackBerry have done so far. Now, of course, the other platforms are trying to catch up. But I guess I just wanted to point out that below the surface, when you're looking at it from a developer perspective, there are these invisible factors involved beyond the obvious that would result in them choosing one platform or another. And that's just something to think about.
Well, Ginny, with regard to Sasha touched on open versus closed, and those aren't net neutrality loaded terms. Open versus closed, and how the stores themselves are managed by, you know, whether it be Apple or Palm or Windows. Can you talk about from, you know, your work in talking to parents and talking to kids, you know, how are you recommending one way or the other? How do you tell parents how to navigate this app world?
Right, I'm calling the app world right now the Wild West of children's tech. That's my big phrase for it, because it's like anything goes in the app world right now. And I'm going to tag a little bit on what you said, in the sense that I think part of the reason that we're getting so many of the apps are showing up in the iTunes store is that there's a very significant thing going on here, which is who's downloading those apps. The BlackBerry users are business users, and they're, you know, you're not really thinking in terms of how do I want to teach my kid the alphabet on your BlackBerry. That's not what you're thinking. You're thinking, where is that big touch screen that might be fun to do some stuff? And that's where you start to see what's happening with the Apple screen is very touch sensitive. The new iPad screen, which if you haven't seen come up afterwards, because I've got one here, I mean, it's incredibly touch sensitive. The Droid screen, again, the Android screen, incredibly vivid and touch sensitive. So yeah, there's a part of these apps which is, where do they play? I'd much rather play an app on something that is exciting for me to look at. And I think that's a factor as well that I just wanted to throw out as in terms of this. But how do you get there? Well, right now we have systems that are these app stores where they're being controlled by, you know, Apple is controlling the way the app store is set up for all the Apple stuff. The Android store, again, they sort of kind of tag along with what's going on with Apple, in the sense that you'll find when you go into these app stores that they've come up with categories, and that's how you navigate. You sort of decide, well, am I looking for something educational for my kid? All right, then I'm going to look under education. Am I looking for, and under education, you're going to see a wide variety of things, but most of the things right now, at least in the Apple store under education, happen to be preschool games. Okay, that's where the market is right now. That's where there's a lot of development. But you also have a wide range of other things, like I think somebody mentioned utilities. You've got photo, different things you can do with photos, so that if you want to manipulate photos, you can do it. I mean, there's a wide range. There's about 20 different categories is what both of them have landed on in terms of how you sort. Then once you get into the game category, which, as we the statistics earlier said on the panel, are about 65%, within the game category, at least on the Apple Store, there's another whole 20 categories. They subcategorize the game. So if you want a puzzle game, you go to the games and then you find the subcategory of puzzles. So there's all of these issues in terms of navigation. A lot of it doesn't feel familiar to people. They're having a hard time sorting through what they're trying to find. And I think that's because we're seeing just a very new industry, and they haven't quite figured out what's the best way to go about it. Part of the reason Common Sense is jumping in, Common Sense, for those of you that don't know, it is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that looks at children's media. Their whole goal is to give information to consumers, particularly parents, so that they can make decisions on what media ought to come into their children's lives. They believe in information, not censorship. You need information about an app, whether it might be appropriate for your child. They want to give you that information so that you can make a decision on whether that's right for you. Right now, within the world of the app worlds, the app developer, is deciding age categories. So in a lot of situations, you've got a 21-year-old kid or a 24-year-old kid, and I don't mean to be age discriminatory, but you've got young, exciting, innovative app creators who may or may not have kids, and they're making a decision that this is really cool. And so sometimes we have within this world, we have some disconnects going on. I know there's a free app on the App Store called Battle Bears, aged at 9. It is a app in which children take guns and they shoot teddy bears. And they do a headshot on a teddy bear, close-up headshot, and the head comes off and he bleeds rainbow blood. Okay, that's aged because on the App Store they say that's 9. Well, I have to tell you, as a parent, if I had a 9-year-old, I do have 2 children, and when they were 9, I would not have wanted them to play that app. That's not an app I would have chose to play. And yet it's very highly rated, it's free, and, you know, for the right audience, it's silly. But the question is, where is that audience?
Baron is actually downloading that app right now.
So there's a lot of issues going on in terms of how do you get information. Apps right now, the app developer gives you some information. You're going to see some reviews, but reviews don't necessarily give you the information you need. Well, and so it's a very hard world at this point to navigate.
Let me build off of that. You know, Common Sense Media is trying to guide parents and helping them with their children, finding apps that are appropriate and kind of steering them away from apps that aren't appropriate. But with 100,000 apps on one app system, it's kind of hard, right? And I think your question or your comments kind of raise the question, and I think across a variety of different issues, not only like appropriateness, but also cybersecurity,
exactly,
privacy, et cetera. Like, who's responsible, and what do we think? Let's forget about liability or hardcore responsibility. Just liability. Let's kind of also think like, where is this? When is it going to solidify in the sense that there's going to be some rules of the road that are consistent? It seems like. My takeaway from the Glenn Lowry speech is they're building 747s in the sky. This is happening so fast. And Android seems to be the same way, where it's just
right.
Happening.
And I think there are a little bit of different systems going on, in the sense that I think the Android world, the Google philosophy is, you know, it's open source. You build it, we're going to let it go out there. I think Apple's a little more protective. It's saying, We're gonna kind of watch. We're not sure there's things on here that we want to be on here. Like when they removed the baby shaking app. I don't know if you guys followed that. That was maybe 6 months ago. There was an app that was supposed to be sort of amusing. It's about a baby crying, and you're supposed to try to do things to soothe it. But one of the things you could do was shake it. And, you know, that sort of sent a totally wrong message because you would never want to shake a baby. And so they ended up removing that app. They just decided it was causing too much controversy. There was a big YouTube thing about it.
Right.
You know, so you have...
But isn't that a case of you're damned if you do, damned if you don't?
Exactly.
And I think for a lot of these issues, that's what it's like. I don't see any legislation or regulation in the next few months. But in the media, in public opinion, I guess the question is, how much responsibility should some of these app store proprietors take with regard to their apps? And if they don't, is it going to be a problem going forward?
I liken the Apple App Store situation pretty often in my head to Walmart, okay, because it is a store. And Apple is basically running a store and deciding what to put on their shelves and what not to put on their shelves. And just like any other physical store where they decide what to put on their shelves and what not to put on their shelves, and public pressure seems to play a greater role than public policy here. Walmart, for instance, doesn't carry a range of adult magazines that are available at your local grocery store. They've decided that that's not for their audience. Every once in a while, the ACLU or somebody gets up in arms about that because they decide that people should have wider access to legal materials. And Walmart says it's our right to put what we want on our shelves, and it pretty much dies down. People can get those materials through other means. The question that comes up is, and I'm not saying I have the answer to this question, is the exclusive tying between the device and the store. Because Apple doesn't just ban baby shaking apps. Apple, for instance, last week very publicly rejected an app by Pulitzer-winning cartoonist Mark Fiore because they don't want any apps that ridicule public figures in their store. Now, they turned that around when there was a lot of public controversy over it, just as brick-and-mortar stores turn around their decisions when there's a lot of public controversy. But the fact that iPhone users cannot go to a local grocery store or to another source to get different apps right now is worth thinking about.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan?
Well, you know, I think that right now the state of evolution in the editorial process of product placement in this new virtual application store universe that we're getting to know the aisles and the selling habits within, it's a riddle wrapped in a mystery, wrapped in a big question mark, where we have Apple rejecting a editorial cartoonists who might have had critical cartoons about a public figure. They still allow various types of print editorial magazines that are rhetorically critical of public policy, public officials, as their public purpose.
Like any store, they reserve the right to be arbitrary.
For example, you can get the Wall Street Journal, you can get the New York Times, you can get Time Magazine, you can download almost all of the big
and
publications.
The Nation and Weekly Standard and other
all
polemical
of those,
types
right.
of journals that exist to be critical of public officials.
Yes.
So there are all kinds of early ironies and missteps and trial by error processes that we're seeing being iterated literally right in front of us. But it is no different than what we saw in the earlier stages of the evolution of the web, the evolution of search optimization, the ways that the existing search engines have actually defined and proscribed certain types of content and content categories, the certain types of iterative business decisions and editorial decisions that many of our companies are making about the kinds of content that they're deploying overseas, like in China. This is a work fabulously in progress. The good news, though, is that we have third parties like Common Sense and PC Magazine and potentially my own organization that are at least trying to make sense of this chaotic process as it seeks equilibrium and order. It's going to take a while.
Let me also say, just make a comparison with the Windows platform and in the PC operating system, if I may. And you can tell me, you can hit me if it's a poor analogy, but it seems like the Windows operating system, with regard to some of the issues that we had, with regard to security,
yep.
Malware, youth safety,
yep.
Pornography, some of those early issues with regard to the burgeoning web. Microsoft, for better or for worse, had a pretty substantial market share.
Right.
Apple Apple had like, what, 2%? Mm-hmm. Developers could write third-party applications for a huge audience on one platform. Like they could write, you know, a filtering piece of software you could download. They could write an anti-spyware piece of software and really reach a tremendous amount of the market. We have so many different devices. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are a fair amount of devices. I think somebody said earlier this morning, Samsung puts out a phone every week or something.
Right.
And we have different operating systems, and we think Apple and Android, but there's so many more. Is that really even feasible? Is that third-party marketplace going to come in and kind of save the day, maybe perhaps like it did, you know, in the Windows platform, or no?
I think what you point out, a key to what you point out is we can't talk about marketplace, we have to talk about marketplaces. Mm-hmm. The smartphone world is going to remain very fragmented for a very long time. We're not going to see a situation anything like desktop computing in the 90s, where 95% of all computers ran Windows. Every analyst I speak to says there will be between 4 and 6 different incompatible smartphone platforms duking it out in the market for at least 5 years to come.
And what's interesting is that when an app is released, it's not released across the multiple platforms. I mean, the one thing you're going to find is, I mean, some of them are, but a lot of them aren't. So you're going to find something in the Android market, and then if you go and look for it in the Apple market, it may not be there. Right. Vice versa, the other way around as well.
I'm smiling because Apple just inserted a clause into their latest developer agreement prohibiting iPhone developers from using certain tools, which makes it easier for them to develop on multiple platforms at the same time. So Apple's trying to stop people.
Yeah, from a consumer point of view, you sort of got to, you know, you're going to have to follow where your device leads you is what happens.
But I think, though, that the next step, though, is that we're actually going to be looking beyond the actual stores as they're defined by the platforms to a universal space. Some people call it a cloud. Some people call it software as a service. We're going to be going to shared space that are not going to necessarily be walled gardens that are controlled and owned by specific platform operators or handset providers. We're going to be seeing a evolution of access to content and applications, much like we saw in the way that we began to find access to other types of digital content like music. I mean, think about music started out online as a universally accessible, though illegally accessible,
right,
on walled garden peer-to-peer architectures.
Yeah.
Those walled gardens sort of were broken down and became open architecture, peer-to-peer architectures. Interesting, innovative models like iTunes came along, that again built the walled gardens up again. And then others began to experiment and deploy other ways that we still get music, from social networks like MySpace and iMeme to subscription models like Rhapsody. There's, I wouldn't say that there's 1,000 flowers, but there's definitely some shrubbery out there. And we're going to see the same thing ultimately, I believe, within the application world. What we see now will be fundamentally different when we meet again in a year's time.
I'm intensely skeptical about browser-dependent and cloud-dependent services as a savior, because if you're talking about kind of browser-mediated quasi-apps, which are basically things you can download off the web that look like apps, mm-hmm. typically they don't have access to the hooks into the hardware that make native apps look and work so beautifully. They're slower, they're clumsier, and this is the nature of working through the browser platform. The cloud, meanwhile, well, we've been talking about the cloud for a long time, and the cloud will be a great thing when we have truly ubiquitous network connectivity, which doesn't drop out on us at random, and I don't see that happening before 2013 or 2014.
Well, let me get everybody ready to ask questions. I assume the microphone, I'm assuming, works. I want people to ask questions, and I have like 1,000. I have many more questions I'd like to ask, but I'm assuming. I think Sasha echoed the entire panel. They want to hear your question. So, raise your hand if you think you might be ready to ask a question. Oh, please take the microphone. I'll hold my questions for a few moments.
Andrew Bennett from Department of Commerce, International Trade Administration. You really gave a very good map of the value chain, but I'd like to just zoom in on a couple parts of it and ask a question and then ask for your outlook on those parts. One is the space between the developers and the retail layer. I guess, if I ask an analogy, who are the record companies? Who might they be? Is there a lot of consolidation that's happened in that space? Are there folks representing a number of developers? And then looking forward, do you see there being more consolidation or less? And then the other side of that is on the retail side, the Walmart analogy, but then just thinking about that vis-a-vis international trade, is there a space for competition in terms of retailers going to other markets and being where like a Walmart has been able to go internationally and be a storefront that's recognizable internationally? I suppose iTunes is that, but do you see that sustaining itself? Or sorry, Apple's App Store is that. Mm-hmm. Do you see that sustaining itself, or do you see room for competition in each of those layers?
Please join me. Let me take the second part of your question. The second question first. I ultimately perceive that existing a fully engaged and successful e-commerce platforms, the Amazons, Yahoos, and others still to come, are actually going to be migrating into the App Store space, and we're going to see more of it, and they are already universal platforms, very, very adept at making accessible, searchable, and deliverable various types of goods, and that's going to include apps. So I think that there will be universal platforms. But again, we can't predict the future and where it will ultimately go. On the first question, can you just state that again? I mean, what was the
asking about consolidation. I'll jump in here if that's all right. You were asking about the consolidation and how many app developers there are. I think one of the exciting things about the app marketplace right now is that it is the place for innovation. You know, a single person that has an idea, it's not that difficult to develop an app. The tools needed to develop it are something that a lot of people can learn. So you have that individual app developer that's got a cool idea and is going to throw it out there, and it doesn't really cost them that much to do it. I mean, I've talked to a lot of app developers. $10,000, and you can do an app in $10,000 for sure. Lots of apps cost more than that, but so you have this great area right now, this primordial soup where things are just percolating, and you can just about find anything. And I think it's really exciting to see that there is such innovation. Gosh, I mean, I can't wait to see every morning when I'm in that app store, what's the new ones today? You know, I mean, what have people thought up? I mean, it's very exciting. So, yes, there's some big players, particularly in the gaming world. You know, the gaming companies are there, EA, Disney. You know, you can link through a lot of them. Most of them, if they aren't there, they're coming. They're on their way. But there's a lot of just individuals or two people, three people, and what I think is fun is they're all over the world. I mean, I'm constantly reaching out to developers. I'm talking to them about what they're developing, when is something new coming. When you're a reviewer of apps, you can actually touch base with people and they give you what is called a redeem code. That's how I go about looking at things, because otherwise it's a little expensive if you're downloading every $10 app. So when I'm talking with them, I'm aware that they try it. If they're successful, what I'm finding is I'm watching somebody that's created a successful app. The next thing I know, about 2-3 months later, they've got a new one. So it's like success is breeding their ability to keep going. So is there consolidation? I think there's a lot of venture fund money in this area right now. And I think that they are in control of some people getting money, because that is where this new innovation was. It's interesting. Again, I know a little bit more about the children's market, and I'm sorry that I'm not so much about the business market, but this is the world I live in, the consumer world market of that sort of thing. And it's been fascinating for me to see that if we look at a trajectory for the last 10 years, back in the end of the 1990s and the early 2000s, edutainment was the key thing within the family world, right? Those were the PC learning games. Then we had the introduction of the next generation consoles. Family entertainment money went to video games because these new consoles were exciting. About 3 years ago, the hot new thing was virtual worlds and MMOs. And that's where all the venture capital money was 3 years ago. Tremendous amount of money went pouring into the virtual worlds. Well, where the venture capital money right now on technology innovation is in the app world. And so we're seeing a lot of exciting new things.
Jonathan?
Well, Ginny, I think your points are really interesting, but I would disagree on one very important thing, which is that I do not perceive in a comparative sense that there is a lot of VC money behind the apps development. There are about 6 or 7 dedicated funds alone. There's a limited amount of actual capital investment at seed or Series A early stage investment going on. Why? Because the business models are still very on shaky ground. Not a lot of people are making a lot of money in apps land.
And yet,
it's a spaghetti thrown against the wall.
Exactly.
Model.
And yet there's a lot of people that are coming into the market even so.
Oh, absolutely. But one of the distinguishing characteristics, and here's where I think there will be an evolution, and I'd love your thoughts, is I had mentioned earlier that right now about 3/4 of the applications that are now deployed in this snapshot of a moment at the very beginnings of this process are paid apps.
Yes.
It's very different from the ecosystem on the internet where almost all content is free, very limited amounts of the total
and,
number.
And smart of them to have discovered that you've got to make money or it's hard to keep going.
Or the other way of looking at it is one of the reasons that there is this mandate and this skewing towards paid apps is because there are platform requirements, but there's also the need to make a buck quickly because there isn't the kind of infrastructure that has existed and flourished in earlier iterations of the web, like venture capital.
Well, and also was what you were saying is when you've got that new app introducing, if they don't have any marketing money behind it, it's hard to get up from way down there when they first release, because when you're in these app stores, the ones that get float up to the top are in the top 25.
And they stay there.
And they stay there. So what you're saying is true. To
interesting.
Yeah.
There were other questions. Oh, Jim DeLong.
Jim DeLong from Digital Society and Convergence Law. Jonathan, could you expand a little on your comment about the 3-part ecosystem? Because I'm seeing about 6 parts.
What are your other 3?
Well, I see in the middle between the app guy and the consumer, I see the handset, you know, the hardware maker, the operating system, where you have the people competing, and then the carrier.
Right.
And it seems to me that they're all putting these things together in different forms, and any one of those can try to be the dominant player in the coalition.
Right. I think you're absolutely right. The niche, the segment that I was trying to refer to, the ecosystem that supports commerce within the applications, where I had the operators I had mentioned are the carriers. The other 2 participants are the developers and us, the consumers. That triangle of actually how do we get an application that can be uploaded and then downloaded and then a transaction completing that process is the triangle that I was talking about. And it is, you know, it is going to be an increasingly multidimensional set of actors, particularly as there are new opportunists perceiving this as a potentially valuable platform for making money. It hasn't, it's necessarily gotten there yet in a broad sense, but it will. And when that happens, there will be multiple participants that we haven't imagined yet.
Sasha, did you want to add?
Yeah, I just want to say that some of those, in at least the smartphone app world right now, some of those elements are fading and some of those elements are joined at the hip. The app store and the operating system right now, for instance, basically come together. Each operating system has a default app store, and not very many people are going to non-default app stores, even if they exist, largely because of a discovery problem, because unfortunately, American wireless consumers have been trained to be lazy. The operator, meanwhile, and this is very encouraging, but the operators have basically stayed out of interfering with the smartphone app market.
Meaning carriers, operators,
exactly.
Carriers.
The carriers. And I do see that continuing even though they're murmuring about doing so, because the carriers are by now smart enough to know that as soon as they start interfering in the app markets and in what they used to call the decks, it becomes a total disaster. Nobody sells anything, nothing gets cleared, and the entire ecosystem collapses. This is something that the carriers have learned over the past 10 years, and they're making a mint right now by stepping back. So I don't see them being too aggressive about stepping back forwards.
Can I ask another ecosystem question, and then I'll go to another question? Jonathan had mentioned earlier about internally built applications. I assume that you mean like widgets and other applications built by, let's say, Apple or built by...
Right, to facilitate and essentially create the architecture for the right. store itself.
And there's some discussion about whether or not they have kind of an advantage of building more elegant, you know, beautiful applications or widgets because of that, because of their position in, as far as the building the operating system and building
the headset. There's no question that people call first-party apps, which are apps written by the people who also write the operating system, have an advantage. In fact, Apple has said very publicly and specifically in their developer agreement, we have access to software tools that you as a third party are not allowed to use. Right. And they've stated that flat out, and right now that's just something you have to deal with.
That was part of the Microsoft antitrust case.
Except Microsoft had 95% of the desktop PC market, and there is nobody with even 50% of the smartphone market, and Apple isn't even number one. So there's no monopoly situation to trigger antitrust.
More questions? I think there were more hands up. Sasha. Baron, Sasha, sorry.
Thanks. I did look for that Battle Bears app, and it's not on Android, unfortunately.
No, it's a Apple.
So I'm curious. This entire time when you all have been talking, I have in my mind Jonathan Zittrain's book, The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It, and he's written a lot about the apps marketplace and about... in his view, the control that companies like Apple exercise. And basically, you know, he sort of paints Apple to be the great villain of closedness. Of course, he happens to own and use an iPhone, but nonetheless rails about how awful it is that Apple has taken devices and pushed them towards what he calls appliance-sized tools instead of generative tools. And my colleague Adam Thier and I at the Progress and Freedom Foundation have been pretty critical and kind of pushed back and pointed out that users like to have apps that work and have things that are, you know, just sort of plug and play. But my question is really mainly for Sasha, but for all of you, I'm fascinated because I hear you saying some of the things that Jonathan is saying, that yes, Apple does control some elements of this, but users like it, developers like it, and that it sounds like what I'm hearing is that there are other forces in the marketplace that maybe cause these things not to be such a big problem, that Apple doesn't have a hugely dominant position. What do you think about his ideas? Are we in danger of Apple, what Larry Lessig called perfect control over the content and the apps that we use? Or do we see the marketplace working pretty well?
Well, I'd like to, as regards Zittrain's frustration over Apple's control, I'm just going to pull out that Singapore analogy again, and I'm going to say, let's say you have Singapore versus a theoretical country which is democratic but doesn't have great sanitation and is a little corrupt and, you know, is generally the quality of life is not so high because of various other problems that have nothing to do with its democratic political system. Would you rather live in Singapore or would you rather live in a troubled place that, well, it has a democratic political system. So the policies, the open or closed policy is not the sum total of the experience, and it's not what the vast majority of people who are not law professors make their decisions based on. So then the question is Apple in danger of ruling the world and putting us all under a scary totalitarian umbrella? No, not right now. It is a vibrant marketplace. It is a varied marketplace. There are new players coming up constantly. I mean, Android has gone from 0 to 38,000 apps in, 18 months? So, Apple has some policies that make me uncomfortable. But there are just so many players duking it out in the marketplace. I don't think we can say anyone's really in control or even really in the lead.
And I would like to add to that in the sense that I'm going to change the question a little bit in the sense that, one thing to say in addition to what Sasha said, Apple's making it easy so that unlike a lot of other of the companies, it's easy to make an app so that you're a lot, that in itself opens the door to a lot of people. What I think some of the issues that we haven't really dealt with yet that I'm just going to throw out here is that as we have this expanding marketplace of apps, we've got some issues that haven't been dealt with. And some of them have to do with Apple, I think, 3 weeks ago announced it's going to start putting ads in its apps?
No. Apple announced that they bought a company which will allow developers, if they so choose, to add Apple-provided ads to their apps where they have been using third-party ad services instead.
Okay, so anyway, my point was, and thank you for the clarification,
Sorry.
We've got some marketing coming our direction. We've got issues, we touched on it just at the very beginning, Tim. There's issues related to privacy. We've got GPS phones, the apps that take that use the GPS. So now we have location-based apps. They know where you are. They know what's going on. Fine if that's what you want, but do you want them to know where your 8-year-old is? I don't know. It depends on what the app is. So there's some issues related to safety, issues related to children.
Ginny, can I jump in there?
Yeah.
And the question is, looking at the ecosystem, it's the app using the phone's location information.
Yes.
And transmitting it, whether it be to other individuals or to the company or to their affiliates or to,
right.
parts
There's
of the chain.
There's a lot of things going on here. And again, to take the company, the Apples and the Verizon positions on this, they're going to say, okay, so now on all these smartphones, most of them come with parental controls. You can turn off that GPS. You can make sure your kid doesn't download something. I mean, you have control on what happens when a child is using it because you have parental controls. Is that enough? I don't know. There's a lot of things going on here. I mean, I know that my sons, when they were teenagers, they had iPhone cards, and boy, they could do whatever they wanted with their music, right? Well, now those same cards, they could do pretty much anything they want to do with those apps unless you tie that into your email account.
Did you have a response, Jonathan? I had, to key off of that, I guess the question from this morning, Common Sense Media.
Yeah.
You already hosted Growing Up with the Mobile Net.
Right.
And one of the first panelist presentations was, everybody saw on the news last night, the Pew Internet American Life Project research on kids in the mobile net and the amount of texting that children are doing. Amanda authored the report. The interesting thing that I think I would ask you is that for whatever reason, and Amanda threw out about 6 or 7 of them, for whatever reason, kids are migrating or have migrated or found that texting is their communication mechanism of choice. And forgive me for butchering your research. Whatever the reason that is. However, whether it be because of network effects or the ease or unlimited texting plans, right now kids are in the sweet spot of texting like crazy a lot. But are we in kind of a safe spot for the moment that kids don't really have access to smartphones, which will probably be a tipping point soon? Will kids all of a sudden have smartphones and be using other applications opposed to texting when everybody has one?
Kids have smartphones now. Actually, if you look at who BlackBerry, weirdly, is selling their phones to, first of all, more than 50% of BlackBerry's sales last year were consumer, not business. And BlackBerry is developing this big market among teenagers who use them for texting. Mm-hmm. Okay, and for this thing called BBM, or BlackBerry Messenger, which exists only on BlackBerries, which has developed these crazy teen social networks that anyone over 30 cannot even perceive.
They're Mayan hieroglyphs.
Exactly. But and BBM has a network effect, because if your friends have BlackBerries and BBM, then you have to get a BlackBerry. But yeah, kids have smartphones. Kids are getting smartphones. Kids are demanding smartphones. Mm-hmm. If you look at any retail survey, the iPhone is the number one demanded product for teenagers at Christmas.
But it's teens. It's not younger kids.
And Amanda did point out in her focus group, forgive me.
It's demanded, but it is not necessarily
right.
Always had at this point.
Right.
The iPhone.
Yeah.
I think the definition of smartphone can be, it's hard to know where it starts and when it ends in a way that the consumer understands, I think. And I don't dispute that there's necessarily kids having BlackBerries.
Can I ask a question to you both, because I think this is very appropriate, thinking about the future. What about the future of the parental controls, content blocks, application blocks? within the mobile and smartphone environment. What are you seeing? What are you interpreting? What are you envisioning for the future?
Well, I think that the tools that, and we've seen it across the board in terms of all of children's media. I mean, we have it in video game consoles as well.
Sure.
You know, we've got these parental controls, but parental controls only work when there's a dialogue going. I mean, they work when kids are young and they don't know better. Mm-hmm. But that's not the difficult area. The difficult area is when kids start getting smarter than you are. And
that's pretty quick.
And it is pretty quick. And there's nothing, no parental control is as good as a parent exercising their rights as a parent. And that means discussions. Talk about, you know, citizenship, digital citizenship. Talk about what happens with GPS location-based games. Talk about all the issues that we sometimes try to fix by putting up these parental controls and just keep everybody away. The bottom line is conversation, talking points,
right,
learning lessons. I mean, we are trying to teach our children to grow up in this digital world and to learn how to navigate it. And the only way we can do that, yes, we can put some parental controls in front of them when they're young, but as they start to get older, we actually really need to deal with these issues.
My kid is not old enough for me to have to deal with these issues yet, but there's a parenting author, I think it's Rosalind Wiseman, who made this really great phrase of saying that if you have a decent relationship with your kids and with your teens, they want the out. They want, and that's the function of parental controls. Parental controls are the out because if you have a decent relationship, then your kid wants an excuse to not do the things they shouldn't be doing, but that they may feel pressured or tempted to do. That's the use of parental controls. If the communication is broken down and the kid is dead set on doing something you don't want them to do, I don't think any software solution is going to stop them.
You know, and that's funny because there's an app that just came out recently, and it's all about telling your kid the countdown of when they have to get off doing whatever you decide it is. It's an app. I mean, again, it's the same sort of thing.
You know, I think, that's odd. You know, what we talked about today in the earlier panel is a lot of what we hear here. Parents do make attempts to regulate the phone and to... We didn't ask specifically about enabling specific parental controls, though they are available on most cellular phones,
yep,
at least through the provider.
Yep.
I think what's hard is that a lot of parents feel behind the times. I mean, we certainly heard from teens about parents who don't text, don't understand texting, don't like it. And that's a fairly basic part of teens' kind of communicative arsenal on a cellular phone. And so I think it gets harder when we're starting to ask parents to really be, you know, hip to some of the newer and more complicated things that they themselves don't use.
Yeah, and I don't mean to self-promote, but that's why places like Common Sense, and we're not the only one, I mean, we're a nonprofit, nonpartisan group that's trying to talk to parents, but there's lots of us out there, and we're giving you those tools. You don't understand it, we're going to explain it to you. So, I mean, there's a real need for my type of organization within this world because it's moving very fast.
I've carved 6 minutes into the coffee break. Let me ask one more question or have someone ask one more question and we'll move on. Any last... Randy?
One quick question. Randy France.
Randy France from Esri. We've heard a lot of numbers thrown out there and I kind of wonder, are we really framing this market in the correct way? Android, 38,000 apps. iPhone, 50,000 apps. I looked at that and did a quick analysis on my computer here. And 50,000 apps, if I was to look at all 50,000...
It's 150.
150, okay. Then my numbers are going to be off. I came up with 138 hours to go through those apps and give them 10 seconds apiece just to look at them to see if I want to buy them. And if we frame it that way, there's probably, and I also heard 25 apps that most people do download. We look at this very perhaps democratic, open marketplace because everybody's there. But if we start framing it down saying that 99% or 95% of people are only buying 25, then don't we start shifting the power more towards the iPhone to say, well, they could have a special deal with these 25 that are really the ones that people are buying and are just ignoring the other ones, and it's more of a bragging right than anything else. So how should we really frame up the availability of apps and which ones are being
used? The value of the app numbers, of the cumulative app numbers, has nothing to do with consumer choice or behavior. It's to tell you how appealing a certain platform is to developers. Okay.
Yeah.
As you said, the vast majority of people do pick their apps out of top apps lists or out of, say, my articles or Jenny's lists from a tiny subset of those apps. The reason to pay attention to those numbers is because those numbers tell you where the app developers are flocking to.
Right. I'd also say that there's a There is ultimately going to be, just as we saw in the development of the web, because remember, I think it was 1997, there was 100,000 web pages, that was it. Well, look where we are now. There will always be a value to the so-called long tail, that Walled Garden's top 40 playlists have limited utility, particularly on platforms that are infinitely expanding in terms of their capabilities, and content offerings and application and services offerings have got to meet that. So I don't know, ultimately, if... You know, I don't quite understand what you mean by power, but I don't know if the weight of the app world will skew ultimately in one direction or another. One maybe final comparison or metaphor is, I'm sure back in 98 there was a very, very fruitful and interesting panel just like this looking at these new search engines, Magellan and Netscape, being predictive and trying to think about both the policy and practical and engineering implications of what this will mean. And it was only 18 months later that a couple of guys, Larry and Sergey, had created a couple of more interesting algorithms, deployed them, and with zero marketing dollars became Google. So I think that's where we are. We've passed Netscape, and maybe we're waiting for Magellan to come into our apps landscape, but we still have a long way to go before we see where it's going.
I think maybe the core of what you're saying and what we're saying is that discovery is a huge and core issue. Discovery is really important. Who controls and who manipulates discovery is really important. Discovery is only going to become more important in the future.
Well, with that, that's a great way to end. So I will. The next panel in here is Spectrum. Across the next door here is locating your privacy. Right now, I welcome you all into, we have coffee and cookies for a brief coffee break. We'll be back here and there at 3:30. So thank you to the entire panel.